You recognize that theme music. It's Political Rewind. Welcome to today's show. I'm Bill Nygut. Jim Galloway, is it time to change that music out?
It's got this funky 1970s beat to it. I kind of like it.
Okay. It's retro, and retro is in.
All right. Well, we'll figure that out. Welcome to Political Rewind. As usual, if you want to watch what's going on in the studio, you can do that by watching us on Facebook Live. Just go to the GPB News Facebook page, and you will find the show there. And also, of course, we always want you to tweet us your thoughts as you hear what we're talking about, and you do that at PoliticsGPB. And, you know, even if for whatever reason, excuse me, you don't want to share your thoughts with us, you ought to follow PoliticsGPB because there are some pretty interesting conversations that go on our feed, even when we're not on the air. All right, let's get right to it. Jim Galloway, I mentioned, is here. It's Friday. He's the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him in Wednesday and Sunday's newspaper, and of course, he oversees the Political Insider blog, which is part of Politically Georgia, at myajc.com. Hi, Jim.
Well, good afternoon.
Good to see you.
We're getting down to cases, aren't we?
Boy, we're getting close. Loretta Lepore, Republican strategist, former communications director for former Republican governor of Georgia, Sonny Perdue. We're going to talk about your former boss at some point in the show today,
okay.
Loretta.
Okay, looking forward to it.
Michael Owens, the chairman of the Cobb County Democratic Party, is here and has got to be worn out. We're going to talk about the fact that last night you moderated a Democratic primary debate up in Cobb County, but that's the third day in a row of debating up your way?
Yeah, third day this week. We covered everything from school board all the way up to the congressional races and the Democratic governor's race.
Well, we'll talk about some of that. And in the NPR studios in Washington, we're really thrilled to have as a first-time panelist on the show Kyle Hayes, who is the co-founder and host of Peach Pod, which is a Georgia politics podcast. Kyle, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, y'all. I'm excited to be with y'all today.
We should point out that you grew up in Woodstock. You went to the University of Georgia. Who did you work for on the Hill? You worked for a member of our congressional delegation?
I worked for State Representative Spencer Fry out of Athens.
Worked at the state legislature. I'm sorry, I misunderstood that. Because you're brand new, give us a moment, take a moment to tell us about Peach Pod.
Sure. So Peach Pod is a podcast that I do with Luke Boggs. He's currently the president of the Young Democrats of Georgia. And we primarily pay attention to the state legislature during legislative session and campaigns that go on from the governor all the way down to state house and state senate races and even some local races during election season. So we kind of try to cover the gamut of it across all of Georgia.
Okay. Jim, they're starting to gain some traction. I hear people every now and then are starting to talk more about it. It's not easy to suddenly make a name for yourself in that business, but they're starting to do it.
Yeah, Kyle, this is long distance. You're in D.C.?
I am, and Luke is in Athens.
Yeah, so it's a nice little internet-based operation there. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Kyle. We're glad you could join us today from the D.C. Offices of NPR. Jim, let's get right to it. You came in the door today with some great new data about early voting, and I think it's really where we've got to start the show. And one of the things that's interesting about it is we've been saying since early voting started, week before last, how disinterested people seem to be, low turnout, this and that. Your new data takes us in a slightly different direction.
Yeah, I was using it to build the Sunday column, and it was it's from a Democratic friend and a well-known number cruncher, but basically it takes a look at the 22,000 people who have cast absentee ballots ballots as of Wednesday evening, and then matches it with the same period 4 years earlier in the last midterm, and what they have see is a number one is a 45% increase in the number of Democratic ballots cast. So now 2014 wasn't a particularly competitive primary because you had Jason Carter and Michelle Nunn as kind of the consensus candidates. But still, that could be good evidence of a surge. And then what they did was they divided the numbers up by congressional district. And what they found was that the largest increases in Democratic balloting came in Rob Woodall's 7th district with a 340% increase.
Republican incumbent.
Another Republican incumbent, Karen Handel, in the 6th, they had a 319% increase. And in the 11th, Barry Loudermilk's Cobb County-based district, that was 100 and, if I can get my eyes to focus on it, 136%. And the other part of this is that the African American percentage of the ballots cast has actually decreased, which would be natural because you're bringing more people.
You got a larger universe.
A larger universe, and you're expanding that universe into into the northern suburbs of Metro Atlanta, which is a relatively white area, an area heavy in white voters.
Well, these are really interesting figures, and let me turn to you first, Michael, because after all, we're talking about your territory up there. What do you think this tells us about what is happening? And this crosses more than one race, of course. I mean, it could have an impact on the Democratic governor's race because of the possibility that if there are more white voters in the pool, they might be likely to vote for Stacey Evans, although we don't really know how to predict that. What do you think it tells us about that race, about congressional races up your way?
Yeah, first of all, I think it does cut across multiple races. I don't think that first of all, I think this echoes exactly what we've known, and those of us within the party, particularly in suburbia, have felt. I've traveled across this state during the primary season, and you know this thing we call the blue wave. I mean, it's real. There's a large substantial that is real.
So you've seen the same numbers that I outlined right there.
I've seen the same numbers, and it echoes the same thing, and it does go back to echo what we know is that. The 6th, the 7th, even into the 11th, these are areas that are very much energized. And within the Cobb County Democratic Party, we've seen, you know, just an outstanding number of new people getting involved, getting engaged, and not just, you know, signing memberships, but people out canvassing, people willing to knock on doors and make phone calls. And I think the other part to it with the African-American vote, that African-American vote is going to come through. It's going to be fine. But we do see the largest growth of this has been with, you know, suburban white voters and particularly suburban white women voters.
Yeah, Loretta, this sort of suggests what we think we're seeing as a national trend, which is Democratic voters seem to be more energized at this point than Republican voters. Yes.
I think that's accurate. Also, we're seeing a lot of Democratic candidates on primary tickets. So in particular, in the 6th and 7th districts, you have 6 candidates in the 7th district on the Democratic side, very diverse field of candidates. They're each turning out their supporters, which, you know, stands to reason that there would be a higher percentage of turnout than in the past, where they haven't fielded as many candidates in previous years. In the 6th district, I think there are 4 or 5 candidates, four at least, on that side of the House. It's indicative of what's going on not only across Georgia but in the country.
I'll tell you what. One thing, Bill, I noticed just last night. I got home. One of the few times I got home in time to watch the local news, and just the number of Democratic ads. Around in the commercial spots, it's something that I haven't seen in coming up on 20 years.
Yeah, Kyle, does it feel to you like the purple wave is really forming off the coast and might be crashing down on the shores?
I think it could be. I think part of the question that I had on some of AJC's earlier reporting about lack of interest in this race was whether or not people were engaged but sort of overwhelmed by news about Trump. And so if these candidates in the 6th and 7th district, they're participating in a lot of events, a lot of breakfasts, a lot of events in the evening. And if people are getting FaceTime with a lot of these candidates, I think that's a good reason for them to get engaged and vote absentee or vote early. And if they're seeing a lot of that excitement among their fellow Democrats, that I think is a good sign that you know, that enthusiasm may translate into some electoral victories.
Okay, can we break this down in terms of a couple of races, Michael? So we've talked a lot about the different approaches that Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans are taking, the different voting blocks they're hoping to appeal to win their primary. And a lot of it, as you know, I even said it in my lead-in, really, talked about maybe if there are more white votes, they're going to go to Stacey Evans, which is really much too reductive a way to look at the race, and I acknowledge that. Nevertheless, Stacey Abrams has been looking at building a base of African-American voters and energizing them, whereas we know Evans has been looking more at the old Yellow Dog Democrat coalition. Do these numbers, especially if the do they give you any suggestion about how it might influence the race?
I really don't think so. I mean, looking at it this early in the race, it tells me that on this and going back to looking at this from absentee ballots, right? And there's a whole host of other issues to get into that with people, you know, now are suggesting we should use absentee ballots more because of the system, you know, may have issues, voter integrity issues. But what I know is lots of people will go out to vote on election day, and people will go vote when voting is more convenient to them. At this point in time, we're either talking about completely absentee voting or the past voting has been going on this past week or so, which has been usually at one location for each county. So the closer we get to election day, the more polling locations that start opening up is going to make it more conducive, especially for Democrats and those people who are a little more constrictive about when they can go vote to actually get to the polls and make a difference.
You could have a situation by the time we get to May 23rd in which that both Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans are right in their own way. These new Democratic voters, they're not likely to be white male blue collar. They're more likely to be suburban women.
Women, right?
And that would be a new feature of the coalition.
It is, Jim, but one that firsthand I have not seen that's willing to break either way. Now, of course, on May 23rd, we'll have a little more insight to that. But I have seen a feverish pitch from suburban white voters, white women, that have lined up just as much behind Abrams as they has Evans. So there's not a clear distinction I've seen thus far.
This is a man walking a tightrope here.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, Michael Owens, we know you're going to be very careful while we're in the primary season. Kyle, what does this tell you about the whether or not Democrats are energized to perhaps oust at least one Republican congressional incumbent, Rob Woodall, perhaps? Many people consider him to be quite vulnerable in the 7th, and if there's a lot of Democrats turning out to vote early, is he going to be in some trouble?
I think he will be, at least based off this energy early on. I think it kind of depends on where this race goes once you get to the general election and how much this is a referendum on Trump, or if Republicans can control a different narrative to create a positive message about why you should elect Rob Woodall instead of why you should vote against Donald Trump. I think that's probably a question that's going to emerge once you get to the general election in terms of whether or not one of these Republicans is vulnerable.
Well, two things I'll kind of add there. I was looking at the Cook Report, which for your listeners who aren't familiar, they are a third-party, nonpartisan group that analyzes trends in elections, and they have Rob Woodall in the likely Republican column still today, and they have Karen Handel in the lean Republican. So Karen is a little more jeopardy, according to their polling or their analysis, than Rob Woodall. The second thing I noted this week was that CNN came out with a new poll, and in that it was talking about at the national level that a growing percentage of voters are starting to focus on the economy as an issue rather than the president as an issue. And so if that remains consistent going forward, then that may play well for some of these candidates who are in these lean and likely districts.
Republican candidates,
yeah. Right.
Yeah, because we've been, you know, it's interesting, Jim. We have talked a number of times about the fact that Republicans thought that their signature bill the tax cut bill. They call it a tax reform act. Many people think it's not really reform, but it certainly did provide tax relief for major corporations. It did put money in the pockets of some individuals out there who got bonuses or got pay raises. But we've been saying that it didn't look as though that tax bill itself was going to be much of a motivator to get people to vote Republican. But if the economy in general continues to boom, if unemployment is down, that's a different way to look at the economic situation and to say it does seem to favor Republicans.
Yeah, it's a matter of what do you see? And as far as the tax bill is concerned, a lot of people don't see their paychecks week to week, but they do see them. They do see the news. They know that unemployment is now down to 3.9%. They see a lot of help wanted signs out there in the world.
And they're looking at their retirement accounts and, you know, seeing them go up rather than down. And there's a lot of other economic indicators that are in the positive range right now. So if that maintains, that's good news for Republicans.
All right. Let's go back to the governor's race for a couple minutes. Michael, you had a debate between Evans and Abrams. And according to the reporting by Greg Bluestein, who was there, I guess was there, got pretty heated between the two around what issue?
Obviously around the Hope Scholarship and who did what, who gave credit to who. And, you know, Leader Abrams basically says, you know, I was the leader. So, you know, these bills that came through and for whatever Stacey Evans can take credit for, you know, she
Abrams
was the leader,
has been criticized by Evans because she joined a compromise that would reduce the amount of money in the Hope Scholarship, directly in the Hope Scholarship. Evans' line of attack is it reduced Hope Scholarships like by 97% for African-American students.
Full rides.
Leader Abrams was quick to say that, you know, the work that she was able to do, that, that you know, clearly that African-Americans were able to gain Hope Scholarships and were able to go to school. My biggest challenge during that debate was getting them away from the Hope Scholarship discussion and on some other things that Democrats may be interested in hearing about. So, I mean, I actually start off by reading some of the responsibilities and duties that the governor has, right? They're very large responsibilities to go in there. So really want to get into some of the other things, such as keeping, you know, the citizens and businesses of Georgia safe, you know, talk about some of the challenges we have with regional transportation across the state, and you know, many other issues besides just the Hope, because we know that's a touchy subject and one that they've kind of warred on throughout this primary season. But I think voters are going to be looking for some of those other areas in which they really want to start keying on.
I read for the first time today Al Scott, a very highly respected African-American former legislator, now the chairman of the Chatham County Commission, and he weighed in, and I think I read him in a story in the AJC, Jim, saying that Abrams, you know, he's defending Abrams on the Hope Scholarship. He's saying Abrams made a compromise in part because they needed more money for pre-K.
Oh, that was Al Williams.
I thought it was Al Scott.
No, Al
I apologize.
Williams.
All right, then you finish that for me.
Yeah,
that
was, he's a State Democrat out of Midway, and basically what he told me was that Democrats had to make a choice. They had to go with, in order to preserve the pre-K program, which Williams argued is far more important to African Americans than to other children, that they had to go along with the Hope Scholarship cuts.
Yeah, I apologize for attributing that to the wrong person, Loretta. This is why I have smart people on the panel, because I get things wrong every now and then. In fact, quite often. Kyle, let me bring you into the conversation again to talk a little bit about, are you still paying attention to the Georgia legislature? Do you have as much opportunity to do that from up there?
I am, yeah. And I think on this question of the Hope Scholarship and this debate between Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams, I think the question that has sort of remained unanswered for me right now is if you take Stacey Evans' criticism of Stacey Abrams cutting a deal with the Republicans to have some sort of path forward for the Hope Scholarship in the wake of the Great Recession, and then you put Stacey Evans in the position of minority leader during that debate, and she is, you know, presumably saying that she would make a different choice Is the other choice to walk away from that negotiation and then try to, galvanize Democrats to get to the polls and oppose these cuts after they were made? And can you look at the performance of Democrats in the state in 2012 and 2014 and look to that to see, would there have been some sort of electoral backlash against the Republicans that would have made the public case that these hope cuts were wrong? I mean, so that, as it relates to that debate between the two of them is a question I think, needs a little bit more fleshing out.
But what's interesting, what I find interesting, Kyle, is that the lines of attack for both of these Democrats involved, what did you do with Governor Nathan Deal and was it proper? On with Stacey Abrams, it was her work with the governor on the Hope Scholarship. With Stacey Evans, it was her cooperation with the governor on the Opportunity School District effort.
Yeah, that's exactly why I asked if Kyle was still watching the legislature up there, is because each of them has got a record in the legislature that they are boasting of themselves but using against the other candidate out there. Let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way. When we come back, I want to talk for a few minutes about the Republican gubernatorial race, but let's get the break out of the way. This is Political Rewind.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows. You're all sealed inside. Take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported this station, and, well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We're back on the air. That's Loretta Lepore that you heard there. Michael Owens in the studio, Jim Galloway, and Kyle Hayes of Peach Pod Podcast. By the way, can people get Peach Pod on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else they get their podcast from?
Yes, they can find it on Apple iTunes. The easiest way is just to Google the words Peach Pod and iTunes together, and we're on medium.com/peachpod.
Okay, terrific. By the way, in my misreading about the Al Williams, who did in fact defend Stacey Abrams for saving money for pre-K, when I said it was Al Scott, which is a mistake, I realized the reason that was sort of dissonant for me is Al Scott, although he's not out there on the front lines, Al Scott is one of the African-American leaders who's been supporting Stacey Evans in this contest, Jim.
In a very, very quiet fashion.
Right. So I need to, that's why I need to make another correction on that. All right. Loretta Lepore.
Yes.
Brian Kemp stirred up a lot of controversy, of course, when he released the commercial in which he held a shotgun in the direction of a young teenage actor who was allegedly trying to date his daughter. And he loved every minute of the attention he got for that spot so much that he released a second commercial. Why don't we play the audio from that commercial and then talk about it?
I'm Brian Kemp. I'm so conservative. I blow up government spending. I own guns that no one's taken away. My chainsaw's ready to rip up some regulations. I got a big truck, just in case I need to round up criminal illegals and take them home myself. Yep, I just said that. I'm Brian Kemp. If you want a politically incorrect conservative, that's me.
So, Loretta, these two commercials back to back, Kemp has really found his voice, and he's found the persona he's determined to project going into Election Day a week and a half from now. Is it effective?
Well, I guess this is his shock and awe campaign because it is drawing attention. And I think it depends on who you ask. I think people are equally divided over the effectiveness of the ads. So if you're talking to some political operatives, they see it as strategically perhaps effective in the fact that he's drawn national attention too, and then that national attention comes back on the state. So there's more people taking note that Brian Kemp is running for governor, and maybe they'll take a second look at him. As he'd vise for the runoff position in the runoff. And then there are those who think that it's just out of bounds and doesn't have a place in politics. So I think it helps Brian candidly with those folks that are supporting him already. I don't know how much it's making he's gaining ground with other audiences that maybe still the undecideds.
Yeah, well, that was the big question. Is this, Kyle, is this going to propel him toward the runoff? Is he generating enough interest and attention that he's going to find voters that do put him into the runoff with presumably Casey Cagle?
I think what he's trying to do right now is create what the definition of the true conservative is. And I think he's vying with Hunter Hill in this competition for the second place in the runoff. Hill's final ad is, you know, about Hill's Christian values and his desire to completely eliminate the state's income tax, which is really different from the rhetoric that Kemp has in this ad about undocumented immigrants, saying people that he calls criminal illegal aliens, that he'll round them up in his pickup truck. To me, that's not much different than the rhetoric that was put out by Don Blankenship in the West Virginia Senate race when he was referring to Elaine Chao, the wife of Senator Mitch McConnell and the transportation secretary, as a way to attack him and some racially tinged remarks in that race. And Blankenship was not successful in that race. I think it's a warning sign.
But if I could interject here, yeah, the messages aren't that dissimilar, but the persona is.
Yeah.
You can debate over whether it's effective, but at least Kemp is trying to use humor to mitigate some of these what would otherwise be a very, very harsh message.
Yeah, I think that is one of the things that he, Michael, you know, I know you're certainly not hoping that Brian Kemp puts himself in a position to be the governor of Georgia, but I think Jim makes a good point. Brian Kemp has a very folksy way about him. He always has. He's a charming personality. He's got a sense of humor. And despite the messages here, you know, talking about rounding up illegal aliens, as he calls them, in the back of his pickup truck, Jim's right. He does it in a way that sort of softens the blow, doesn't it?
You know, I'll be honest. For everyone listening, if you have not seen that latest video commercial, please go see it. I actually thought it was like an SNL parody, right? I was waiting for the punchline and to find out that it's actually real. So conservative that you are what? What he is, he's on kind of the wrong side of where Georgians are today. You know, there's a recent poll that came out, and I think it said only 7% of those respondents wanted looser gun regulations, right? The majority either wanted what we have or more.
Thank you for saying that, because that gives me a great segue to talk, Jim Galloway, about a column that you published at the end of last week. Sunday, I guess.
No, Wednesday, actually.
Wednesday.
It was much more recent. It just blurs together.
I guess I saw it before then, but... tell us why what you think here in Georgia, why you believe that Republican candidates for statewide office are doubling down on their advocacy of free use of guns.
No, I think the key line in that column was that this emphasis on the Second Amendment in the gubernatorial race on the Republican side isn't despite Parkland, despite what happened at that Florida high school, but because of what happened.
And tell us what that means.
And basically, you've had, since February 14th, you've had this tremendous pushback by the National Rifle Association and your Second Amendment enthusiasts all over the country, and they make up a significant part of the Georgia campaign. And you had a group of GOP candidates for governor starting their campaigns right about then. I mean, that's their campaigns really started to heat up with that as that shooting hit the airwaves, and they had a choice. You could either stand in front of that wave with your arms outstretched and try to stop it, or you could try to find your surfboard. And everybody in the Republican field went in search of looking for their surfboards.
Which is going to be good for the primary, but when we go into the general and they realize that the vast majority of Georgia voters do not want guns everywhere and do not want to have less restrictive gun laws, they're going to pay for it in a ballot in November.
Now, so let me ask you about that. Kyle, let me throw it to you, and then Loretta, I need you to weigh in on this, please, too. If I'm a Democrat running for governor, just hypothetically, and I've got a pro-gun Republican opponent, I mean, I'm not going to run a commercial. I don't think in Georgia. I'd be a little cautious about a commercial that says, if you vote for Republican Casey Cagle, Brian Kemp, He's going to expand your rights to carry guns everywhere because some of the votes you're going to try to win to get across the finish line in a purple state like this are going to be from people who may support gun rights but are not going to be in it favorable to your blasting somebody, a Republican, who's making an all-out push. Boy, I just mangled that, Kyle. Save it. Save me.
That's okay. I don't know that it would make it into a TV commercial, but there's all kinds of ways that candidates can communicate with their supporters these days on social media. And so I could see, you know, maybe some targeted stuff there related to this issue. And I think for Democrats, they're probably going to want to flip the way you look at that conversation from not a conversation about gun rights and your right to own a gun, but about gun safety and about the government's failure in a lot of situations related to school shootings and other things.
I think that's very valid. And I think we've heard from the Democratic candidates already on this that, you know, about, you know, they favor responsible gun ownership. And there are many Democrats across the state who grew up in rural Georgia and grew up, you know, hunting with their fathers and families and enjoy that recreational activity and support the Second Amendment as earnestly as Republicans, but they just are talking about it in a wholly different way. And I think that discussion will come to bear in the general election.
Yeah, believe it or not, there are Democrats out there that are gun owners. And I think that's one of the first things. You know, and I think Republicans are going to find themselves where they are actually running away from the moderates, the independents are out there, that they're going to need those votes, not by what Democrats are doing, but when you're having commercials where you're pointing guns at kids and where you're blowing things up in the background, it is not a function of what Democrats are going to do. Democrats are going to continue to talk about gun safety, gun controls, sensible gun laws, which I think the majority of Georgia voters are going
to
be.
Yeah, if you translate it to can your kid go to school and not come home in a box, that's the conversation.
Well, that's another thing right now. I think we just now had the second county school system in the state of Georgia that now has said it's okay. You know, they're going to work with the law for the teachers to carry weapons at school. Yeah. And this, again, is not something that Georgia voters or Georgia citizens really support, whether you're Republicans or Democrats. You look at the polling numbers around that, which some just came out a couple of days ago. Again, does not support that as a whole.
All right, I want to change the subject. Jim, there's a really interesting little race going on right now. Who is Matt Gertler? And aside from the fact that he's a Republican legislator, what has he done to make David Ralston and the Republican governor so upset with him that they're campaigning against his returning to the legislature?
Matt Gertler is from Tiger, Georgia, way up in the mountain region. He's a young fellow. I think this was his third session. He's been reelected once, and he is kind of the Dr. No of the House. He votes against everything. He votes against not just Democrats. He votes against the House Speaker David Ralston's agenda. He votes against House Rules Committee Chairman John Meadows' agenda.
Votes against the budget.
He votes against the budget, so he's voting against the governor. And so what you've had now, you've had the House Republican leadership pull in about $13,000 to his opponent, Mickey Cummings, who's a Blairsville farmers market manager. And on Wednesday, they've got another fundraiser, and Governor Nathan Deal is going to show up at it.
Loretta, it's just such an interesting, and of course, Gertler says they're after me because I won't play their game, basically.
Right, that he won't vote along party lines, but he's not voting yes for anything. And that's the point his opponent is making, is that certainly there are issues on which you're not going to go along, you know, just because the party's going along with that or the leadership's going along with that. But at some point, you have to acquiesce and vote yes on something, because he feels that his opponent that the voters in that district are being shortchanged. And then, you know, and that does begin to have an effect on your constituency when you are not playing well in the sandbox, because then you're not able to effectively advocate for those things that are important to your constituents.
You don't get those grants out of the governor's office.
There you go. Right.
Yeah.
You know, Kyle, go ahead, Michael.
I think it's a little bit larger than that. I think, and I don't know him personally, but from what I've read, seriously, being one of these ultra-conservative candidates that believes in the limitation of government so much that that no is a very common thing. And it brings some perspective to it. Overall, Republicans voted 6% of the time no. And Democrats, obviously being in a majority, was up higher than that, was at 12%. Matt voted no 40% of the time. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's over three times higher than what Democrats are voting no on.
Yeah, Kyle, I was going to say that he's sort of the Ted Cruz of the Georgia legislature. But Cruz is really no longer the least popular member of the United States Senate within his own party. I think he's been supplanted by Tom Cotton, who is now the least like Republican in his own Republican conference. But he's got a little of that same thing going for him, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think Cruz has rehabilitated his reputation a little bit. But I do think that this is probably, from the perspective of Republican legislative leadership, this is probably a smart move. If Gertler is not a reliable vote for them, if this blue wave cuts into their majority in the legislature, then every vote on the floor and in committee is going to be a lot more important. I mean, if they can't count on that vote, then I think, you know, they have good reason to look for somebody that can play nicer with them.
That's a good thought. And we've had a couple of other instances in when GOP House members have been torpedoed. We had a member from Kennesaw who's very, very much a libertarian. He was deep sixed, as well as a couple, I think, in Cherokee.
All right. Well, it's going to be fun to watch that unfold. Let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way and come back and talk about Sonny Perdue and the Farm Bill, your former boss, who has got a big farm bill that he's got to get passed. But there's at least one element of it, Loretta, that's very, very controversial. We'll take that up after the break.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, elephants shake the earth as they walk. And as seismology grows more sophisticated, could we use these rumbles to prevent elephant poaching? Plus, if you're always running out of time, no problem. Physicist Carlo Rovelli tells us why time doesn't really exist. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Loretta, the Farm Bill, which is one of the big, big pieces of legislation that Congress has to address, is up right now for consideration. And the item in it that has caused a great deal of controversy and is being supported by Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue is a requirement for work in order to receive SNAP benefits, what we used to call food stamps. It's something Donald Trump is supportive of, has said is important, and Sonny Perdue is picking up that charge and moving it forward. Your thoughts?
Well, Georgia's already doing that. So Georgia's been at it, and that program is expected to expand. Under the Welfare Reform Act of 1996, under Bill Clinton, this was originally put in place under that program, a work requirement. And subsequently in 2012, President Obama allowed states waivers to back out of the work requirement. And so we're seeing states take different types of actions. And now we're at this place where, again, we're coming back. And of course, this was an issue that the president spoke about on the campaign trail. And the secretary is now the chief negotiator on Capitol Hill, trying to explain this program within the broader farm bill.
So, you know, it's interesting, Jim, that Loretta talked about President Clinton, because it is easy to forget that when he first mounted his campaign for president, as governor of Arkansas, he had been a big advocate of welfare reform, of a work requirement. And when he began his presidential campaign, he sort of styled himself as the new kind of more conservative Democrat who was willing to look at issues like how do we give out welfare and what do we expect in return. So it isn't like this is a Trump outrage. As Loretta points out, we've seen this sort of thing before.
You've seen it before, but But the fact is that most people who get SNAP benefits right now are working.
Well, that's
caring. So at that point, it begins to seem a little punitive. It's interesting. We've got two Georgia figures really heavily involved in this fight. Of course, you've got Sonny Perdue, who's been living at Capitol Hill trying to make his case. But then you've also got David Scott, the congressman from the 13th. And he has been very vocal about what he sees as the racial motivation behind this. I mean, he's put out some incredibly hard statements on it.
The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which is a nonprofit think tank in Washington, and which in fact whose founder received a big MacArthur grant to which establishes, I think, to some extent, the bona fides. They have an interesting take on this. They've done a deep dive, and so have other people as well, but they came up with similar conclusions to other studies. Nearly three-quarters of adults who participate in SNAP in a typical month work either that month or within a year of that month of participation. Over half of individuals who are participating in SNAP in a typical month in mid-2012, where they have reporting figures, were working in that month. Furthermore, 74% worked in the year before or after the month. And you can go down the line here and see sign after sign, Kyle, that it isn't as though, you know, we see this attempt over and over again to paint people who receive government benefits as sitting around doing nothing, just waiting for the government check to come in. And the data just doesn't show that's correct, Kyle.
Right. And I think that these policies are really more aimed at trying to take access to these benefits away from people who are currently benefiting from them. For people who are not working, they typically have good reasons for not working. And so these proposals, as they've come up in food stamps and in Medicaid and other issues, they aren't really aimed at, you know, making work easier to access for people or improving people's economic outcomes. They're more often aimed at trying to reduce enrollment in these programs so that you can shrink the cost of them from the government's perspective.
Well, and what's interesting about that, Michael, is that while Kyle is right, that's the argument, the fact of the matter is that it would be a minuscule dent in the federal budget if you rolled back SNAP benefits.
Yeah, and this is one area where I'll give Congressman Scott a lot of credit. He has been very vocal about what this would do, and he said it's hurtful, it's mean, it's deceitful, it's un-American, and it's downright racial. You know, the idea of taking 1.6 million needy families or needy people off of SNAP simply by creating this platitude that people just want to sit around and get a handout. And as you said, data has been poured over time and time again and shows it's just not true.
I think this is, you know, first of all, I wanted to say one thing about this applies to able-bodied people who are receiving SNAP. So I think under the new guidelines, it would be that you would be 60 or younger. If you were a parent, your child would be older than six. And so you would be expected to perform work. They've also changed some of the other qualifications. So the type of car you have can be, you know, more expensive. The amount of savings you have can be at a higher level so that more people at higher income, because the program, if you are listening to conservatives talk about this, this is an attempt to control cost. You know, as with most safety net programs, is controlling the cost of program. And what they will argue is that the safety net programs are in place to help people in times of need and to help them to better their lives, not to be programs that are programs that they remain on for perpetuity or for long periods of time. They're supposed to be temporary programs to get people up and on their own two feet again. Everybody, you know, people fall on hard times. There's a recognition of that. And sometimes you just have to give them a little help up. But it's not intended to be a long-term sustainable program.
But if people are, Kyle, if I take Loretta's point, but if such an enormous percentage of SNAP recipients already are working at least some of the time, if not most of the time, and they're working in very, very low-level jobs, they don't have the ability to continue to get jobs that give them more and more money, how do you deny them benefits?
Well, and I think some important context, too, is that, you know, this increases the age that the current work requirement applies to. I think it's currently 50 and it goes up to 59 in this bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is bringing older workers into this who, if they fall on hard times, they're going to have a harder time getting a new job if there's somebody who's 55 and who's trying to get into a different industry or something else in the workforce. And so, you know, I do think it is just another barrier. To people from climbing the economic ladder.
Jim, if this doesn't make an enormous impact on the budget, and if Loretta's right, you know, that safety net programs are there to help people in times of need, I get all that. But this, how do you avoid thinking of this as being, number one, much more just a blatant appeal to your base if you're a conservative Republican? Or how do you avoid thinking of it as social engineering to an extent?
Yeah, and here's the other problem is that your SNAP benefits often go to areas where there is a systemic problem as far as employment is goes, and you'd be surprised to know that the largest part of it doesn't go to urban America; it goes to rural America. And those are Trump voters.
Loretta, give you a chance to respond to that real quick before we move on.
I would agree with Jim. I think that, the other thing I would say is that I think Representative Scott, while he has been very verbal, I think that there will be a time when there is a very level-headed discussion about this, and they will come to some reasoned conclusion. If you recall, Representative Scott was one of the key members that helped Secretary Perdue through confirmation. Yep. He sat at the table with him, and they've known each other for quite some time, and I suspect that they are likely to have a very reasoned conversation on this topic.
Okay, we'll watch and see how that develops. One last issue as we start running out of time. Jim Galloway, it looks like Atlanta has been asked by the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, to submit a bid for the 2020 Democratic Convention. They didn't do it without Atlanta having expressed interest in it, obviously.
Right.
But the Democratic Committee has picked, I think, 8 cities and said, mm-hmm. Give us your best shot. Houston is among them, San Francisco.
Birmingham
and New York are among them. What would be, if you're the chair of the DNC, is Atlanta where you'd want to put your convention in 2020?
Well, number one, I'd want to know who my likely top candidates for president are going to be and what their geographic strengths are going to be. And I would probably avoid a place like, I would avoid San Francisco.
I think San Francisco is the worst idea imaginable.
You'll recall in 2012, Barack Obama had the convention in Charlotte, which in an attempt to turn that state, it didn't quite work. But it wouldn't surprise me to see something like that happen again.
And there's some reporting actually out that Charlotte is vying for the Republican convention this go around.
Michael,
work on both sides.
Michael, tell me how your party would take advantage of how you in the party here in Cobb County would take advantage of the convention to bolster Democrats in election campaigns.
Well, we'd have some great parties to start with.
it'd be a great opportunity to pull Democrats into the fold of electoral politics and party politics that just normally wouldn't, right? I mean, conventions are expensive. They're far away. They're hard for people to get to. So number one, bringing them into Atlanta will just energize a lot more people and get them to come and be involved in the party apparatus itself. And there's great reason for it. I mean, Atlanta is the jewel of the South. We are quickly becoming a red to blue state. So I think I'll definitely be a champion for that cause to bring the convention.
Okay,
here.
Okay. Here's the other thing, Bill. Who's going to be the governor?
Yeah, that's a great question. Mm-hmm, yeah. You're going to have a Republican. You don't have to, but if you had a Democratic governor in office. I mean, the other way around. You wouldn't want to have a Republican governor in office. Kyle, your thoughts?
Well, I think 2018, the elections that go on might be sort of an interesting sign early on because you have, Stacey Abrams is a pretty well-known national figure that could keynote a convention in Atlanta, but you have a contest between Beto O'Rourke and Ted Cruz over in Texas. And so if you're the DNC looking at which of these may be big southern states you could flip and kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to run against Donald Trump in re-election, maybe this 2018 race for governor and for Senate over in Texas is kind of an early test.
Yeah, you know, that strikes me as a really good point because the fact of the matter is that we're, Jim, by 2020, it is, you know, Michael says it's the state is trending toward blue. It sort of is. It's slowly maybe going in that direction. But it does appear that in Texas, there may be more opportunities to flip a couple of seats than there really is going to be in Georgia.
Yeah, although part of me looks at Texas and say that's such a high mountain to climb there.
Well, yeah, but maybe that's why you want the convention there to help you do that.
Yeah, but you're going to be – look, this is – Donald Trump is going to be a whole lot harder to beat in 2020 than a lot of Democrats think. And so I think they're going to have to play this location of the convention very, very carefully.
Okay. So the last time we had a Democratic convention in Georgia, of course, was 1988. I remember covering it. You do, Galloway. Kyle, you're a millennial. Were you a little baby when that convention happened in 88?
I was not here yet.
That just doesn't even sound good.
Oh, that's it. That's it. I think we've, at least a couple of us have voted, you can never come back on this show. We're really out of time for today's Political Rewind. Kyle Hayes, it was a real pleasure having you on the show today. Will you come back?
Yeah, definitely. It was great to be here.
Okay. The co-founder and host of Peach Pod. A podcast on Georgia politics. Michael Owens, thank you. I know how tired you are after all the debates that you've put together.
Ready for a relaxing Rhett weekend.
Lepore, we always love having you here. And Galloway, thank you. And boy, I got to tell you, I'm going to go take a nap because I think I've set my record for misstatements on this show today, and I hope to never come to this point again. So thank you all for tolerating me today on Political Rewind. Thanks to you, Tom Faust, Tyler Morris, for your work. Chris, thank you for running Facebook Live for us. We are back on Wednesday with another Political Rewind. And let me also, as long as I'm talking about it, tell you that next Tuesday, Election Day, we're going to be doing a special, the Tuesday after next, we're going to be doing a special edition of Political Rewind at 2 o'clock. So we hope you'll all join us for that extra day of Political Rewind then. Thank you all for being with us for today's show. Nap time for me.